J.Q. Blackburn, a.k.a. the Human Wrecking Ball, a.k.a. the Danger Ranger, Unit 0, Designation 6. I have several complaints to file and I want to get them out of the way immediately. First, the level of communication between static leadership and the members of the Corps and the co-op is grossly inadequate and continues to create dysfunction. I'm going to keep making this point until the issue is resolved. The Static Corpsman's Codex, which is meant to replace both the Doom Trooper's Guide and the Corpsman's Code of Conduct, does not provide sufficient guidance for new members to operate successfully within our charter as a branch of the United States military. Third, and related to the last complaint, the Codex was also not approved by the Static Cooperative, which is the civilian oversight body for the Corps. While the Codex's use has been adopted by leadership units in the Corps and is now being adhered to by a majority of active duty Corps members, because it has yet to be ratified by the co-op, it has placed the organization in limbo. Fourth, when the Code of Conduct was abandoned, along with it went the engineering and mechanical standards, which provided for uniformity in equipment and design. As such, the interchangeability of parts and transferability of hardware across regions has been greatly compromised, leading to a decrease in the rate of mission success and, in extreme cases, multiple deaths. There have also been multiple instances of friendly fire and a general rise in units working against each other. Fifth, the current negotiations between the Sovereign Businessmen's Association are in direct violation to the Mutually Assured Destruction Compact agreed to by the Static Co-op and the SBA. Six, the new unit designation model and identification method is confusing. I read the 3-page document, and that's 3 pages front and back, mind you. And if I understood it correctly, my unit designation would now be 1X Prime. Okay, this isn't actually a formal complaint. It's just a pain in my ass. Now, piracy is one of my favorite pastimes. And by piracy, I mean actual ship and water seizing of vessels. The open sea, salt spray in my face, all that. You have to see the active sea lanes to believe them. Long lines of cargo ships stretching from one horizon to the other, sometimes in traffic so heavy it comes to a standstill. The decks of these ships are packed with everything from cargo containers to whole buildings, sometimes even people. The open ocean is a dangerous place. Roaming patches of broken space can swallow ships whole. The list of biological threats is infinite. And we are not the only ones who like to engage in buccaneering. There are also whole cities submerged, not to mention private facilities, and huge fleets of ships above and below the surface. The water in the sea lanes is also a threat. The technology used to control the water makes it highly charged. Falling in means death in minutes, if not instantly. If your ship's hull isn't on the right frequency, it can be disintegrated. And that frequency can be different for every company and every ship. The ocean is also an even more lawless place than the land, so the things done out here can be even more bizarre and barbaric. Sea lanes are also a black hole to many static scans. This, more so than any other reason, is why the cargo ships being used to move equipment from Region 1 were diverted from the OMNS. Unit 2 Plus Alpha has been posting their own version of the events surrounding Control Alt Delete Reset, not as part of the investigation, but directly to the Statosphere, where they've insinuated that the only way we could have known where the cargo ship was and gotten into Miami undetected was to be in bed with Versal Services. It's fair to say that everything Unit 2 Plus knows can be summed up in 500 characters. There are bunches of ways to find things on-grid or off-grid when static scans fail, even in quote-unquote undetectable places. I also want to refute their claim that we paid the people who sailed with us anything. We promised them nothing but the right to plunder, which is guaranteed in the C3. I do not know where Pharaoh got the ship we used for our assault on the cargo vessel Ontario Snow. When we finished planning in the war room at the hospital in Bosnian, we immediately headed for the dock. Someone handed him keys. I learned a long time ago not to ask questions I don't want or need answers to. I will confirm that the vessel was able to transverse from off-grid onto the digital field without using a gate. We were able to track the Ontario Snow right up until it entered the Namib Canal. By now, I hope you've taken the time to review the comparative maps of the globe so you have some sense of where these places are. Africa continues to be the least known place among new inductees, but that is where the future of this conflict will unfold, so I hope you get to know it. The Namib Canal cuts clean across the African continent, connecting the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. It's actually a pair of 2-mile-wide canals, one eastbound, one westbound. I don't know how we entered the westbound canal going east, but I assume it had something to do with the design of the vessel. But since I wasn't piloting, I can't say anything about how it operated. What I do recall is the sound of the ship creaking and being told to hold on, we're about to dive. I could feel the ship descending, and everyone switched over to the silent comm and verbal communication was suspended. So there's no confusion. Shipping submarines are very common. Most of our ocean-going vessels can operate on sea level or below the surface. The Ontario Snow, in particular, is a Namibimax class vessel that can ride on the water or below. It's 3,000 feet long, 250 feet wide, and 125 feet tall. It's a floating city. One of the things Unit 2 Plus and their cronies didn't know about were the redundancy measures built into bases, and the Ontario Snow is actually considered a base because of its size. It took no special effort or force for us to enter the ship. My command code still worked, so all we had to do was get close to the vessel and a port opened up. And since I had master command clearance, not so much as an open door light turned on when we went aboard. There were 927 people on board, most of whom were passengers. There were 100 crew and about 100 security. The first step was to isolate the sections of the ship so people could move around freely, especially anyone on the security detail. There are very specific rules regarding civil conflicts within the Corps. At least there are when we're using the C3. Lucky for them, we were. We packed only non-lethal weapons and went with high restraint combat. Basically, we ran around gluing people to walls and tying them up so they couldn't disrupt our takeover effort. Because the ship was so packed, most of the people were being housed on the upper decks. There was no way of telling if they would be for us or against us, so we locked them down. Security on the command and control level is more manual. Large doors with big locks, a maze of rooms and corridors that are purposely designed to confuse anybody who isn't familiar with the layout. They had locked everything up tight because they had figured out something was going on, but they didn't know about the Jeffries tubes, all of which had hatches that could have been sealed. We crawled into the belly of the command deck through these narrow passages, positioning ourselves around the bridge, just waiting. After a few minutes, Pharaoh crawled out of the floor right in front of the guy who had made himself captain. And before you ask, yes, a headless man can actually stare someone down. He didn't have to say much. I'm taking control of this ship. You can join me or take a dip in an escape pod. I'll have to give it to Captain James, Unit 2 plus Zeno. His whole crew was ready to go to war until we stepped out from behind the consoles and they realized we have the whole room locked down and about 80% of their security force was either glued to a floor or locked in a room. The hijacking of the Ontario snow has been seen as particularly subversive. After looking at many solutions for rescuing Unit 675 and as many of the other people whose distress signals we confirm, none of it worked without a fully functional complement of equipment and people. We had to go into a class 4.5 city, and on top of that, New York was coming south. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but again, I want to say that everybody who joined our effort did so of their own free will. Shell ordered me to inform the crew of the takeover, to let the passengers know what was happening and where we were headed, and give everyone an opportunity to disembark. She also told me to make it sound dramatic, and to be sure I told him who I was. I said something along the lines of, "This is General Blackburn, commander of static forces during the battle at Guillotine Prairie, serving under the command of General Mandarigma. We have joined the army of the headless dead pharaoh, the unresurrected grave walker returned from the wall of tombs that is about to choke off the Gulf of Mexico. We are returning to the city of Miami to respond to Unit 675's distress call, and we are responding to all the distress calls we can across Region 1. If one or all of you wish to disembark, we will make a stop at the nearest OMNS station. If you sail with us, we offer you nothing but danger, glory, and plunder." Calling ourselves an army at that point was clearly overstatement. We were all of maybe 15 deep, but only a couple of people decided to jump ship, so our rank swelled pretty quickly. Miami's security systems had been in a state of constant improvement for 2 years in their preparation for becoming a Class 5 city. The security was even tighter with the Kings of New York coming into town. On top of that, Unit 675 was in Tardatatec's solar headquarters. Every operation in the solar system was controlled from that location, so the layers of security had layers of security. And Tardata was the company that held the contract for managing the city of Miami, so they had additional forces and resources at their disposal. Now, Unit 675 had managed to find the softest spot in the whole cityplex as their entry and exit, but we were still talking about the central cityplex in the heart of Miami. When executives from cities like New York, Tokyo, Paris, these tier 5 capitals, when they travel, whole grids have to be reformatted. Sections of a city are cleared, the digital field frequencies are reprogrammed, and the grid is rebuilt to the specs of the visitor's location. For these titans of industry, their businesses are built to run on their home grids, and part of the way they keep power is by controlling the grid format. So if they're going to be in any place for more than a day, everything gets rewritten. These kinds of visits are a double-edged sword. The Kings paid for the space reformatting, but it also gave them a permanent foothold in the city should they choose to stay. Many a city has been lost by the slow creep of intrusion when a guest decides they don't want to leave. I cannot confirm any details about Pharaoh's whereabouts in regards to the question of whether he was responsible for a series of flash blackouts in New York City or if he even traveled there. I am barred from travel into or even through New York and have provided my unredacted GPS location data for the times in question. I will confirm the accuracy of the equipment service record that I'm looking at and state that while on board the Ontario Snow, I performed the overdue scheduled maintenance for the BW1-19-90, aka the Big Worm. I did not ask and do not know if or how the tunnel boring machine was employed. After greasing it up and shaking it down, I left it secured in the hold of the Ontario. Unfortunately, this piece of equipment has been permanently removed from the inventory because it was destroyed while on deployment, and there is no indication as to its final location. The record of its last location placed it at the Norfolk Sound OMNS. Pharaoh was very specific in not divulging all the details during our planning. The last time I saw him before we interrupted the games in Golfiana was at Bermuda Bay, where he and an unknown count of digits remained behind after offloading untold amounts of cargo from the Ontario snow. Shell then took command of the ship and we sailed south. The decision was made to split up and attack from multiple places, one because the distress signals were all over the map, two because it was clear no amount of planning was going to result in the immediate destruction of the wall. Pharaoh had been limited in what he could decipher when he was plugged into the grid, and now that he had more data and context from other grids as well as our static sources, he found that the Gulf Gate was actually integrated into several major cities. Once the planning AI took stock of all the data points, it gave us a projection of several months to 2 years before we would be able to take down the wall with anything that looked like a safe outcome. But that only gave us a 50-50 chance of either failing or succeeding with a massive loss of life. And that was if we started that day. Golfiana would have been fully built by that time, the cities would have been even more secure, and the odds would have just been even more against us. The full list of operational fronts we would have had to coordinate was as long as my arm and included Space City, Miami Cityplex, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, Chicago City, and just about every other major city in the Southern American states. I remember when that whole area was called Mexico. Not only could we not destroy the wall from the first flex, we also wouldn't have been able to take it out without causing catastrophic damage to most of the cities along the Gulf Coast and killing tens, if not hundreds of millions of people. We stopped the formal strategizing at that point when it became clear we would have to get every major city linked to the barrier to reconfigure their grids. Nothing like that had ever been done. Two cities was common. Five was a record. We managed to get more than a dozen cities to reformat before we sent that wall into the sea. A long time ago, the Chaos Doctrine became standard practice for the static core. In short, it teaches that loosely and or uncoordinated actions can be just as, or in some cases, even more effective than complex strategies. Some call this guerrilla warfare, rebel tactics, or liken it to terrorist cells that operate independently so they can't compromise each other. The bottom line is, it becomes all about the goals of the big picture. With an organization like Static, where you have untold numbers of people in the co-op and the core, some of whom are working a complex plan and some of whom are out here on the seat of their pants with covert resources and untold capabilities, it just works better not to try to coordinate everything. The reality is, we're not fighting for strictly defined territory. We're not fighting a single enemy or even an alliance. Victory is not as simple as toppling an empire. With an enemy like the sovereign and corporations, it's a war on all fronts. We made about half a dozen stops while sailing south, dropping off people and equipment before we made it to Miami. I didn't have time to be surprised that Pharaoh didn't join us for the rescue of 675. I just took it as a sign of his trust in our capabilities. I spent a lot of time in Miami before going in the freezer, and even though the city had grown and changed a lot on the surface, its bones were still the same. Again, the problem we faced was our infrastructure being all out of sorts. I didn't have time to be surprised that Pharaoh didn't join us for the rescue of Unit 675. I just took it as a sign of his trust in our capabilities. We made about half a dozen stops while sailing south, dropping people and equipment before we made it to Miami. I spent a lot of time there before going into the freezer, and even though the city had changed a lot on the surface, its bones were still the same. Again, the problem we faced was our infrastructure being all out of sorts. Palm Island, short for Port of Miami Island, had been a major hub for our logistics and business in the region, as well as our shipbuilding operations, but it was left to the vultures like so many other places. Even every major facility has a secure mode where it can be buttoned up and concealed. They even have self-destruct measures should the site need to be scuttled. I pieced together that Unit 2 plus Alpha's plan was to make it look as if the core had collapsed unexpectedly. Ironically, anybody who really knows anything about how we handle business knows we would never leave a place wide open like this. We never leave a trace of where we are or what we're doing. Palm Island wasn't as bad as some places. A few squatters had made home, taking advantage of the automated greenhouse grocers and the shelter. My unit had a mixed-use building on the grounds, a place with some apartments, manufacturing, and storefronts, which we left locked and stored when we went into the freezer. We weren't the only ones. Shell gave everyone 120 minutes to get whatever they could or needed and to get down to business. By this time, Monaco, Cam, and Cakes were rolling with me. The others spread out. Dade was off to Space City with Law and Hi-Rez. Cakes and Shell got refreshed, hopped in a smaller ship, and some others kept pushing to points west of Miami. The second flex is very different from being on the floor. Sometimes I think it's what the world would have looked like if space hadn't been broken. Security first, second, and third, motto number 19, is both a statement of fact and a warning. It is very easy to be targeted and killed in the city proper, so you must always remain vigilant about your security and the security being used to monitor the grid. The second flex has a goal, and that's to achieve what they like to call solid state security, meaning that down to the millimeter, they are aware of what is on grid and where it's going, what it's doing, and who's it doing it with. When properly suited and calibrated, digits are more or less invisible to the digital field even here. Be warned, I said more or less. Not absolutely. The most common way Corps members get nabbed is by naked eye observations or because they are carrying Di-Fi connected devices they fail to disable. I'd forgotten that I'd left one of my favorite suits in Miami. It's the one I'm wearing in the video clip where I get blown out of Tardata Tech's back door and slam into the car, the dark green three-piecer with the orange lining. It's not one of my favorites because it makes me look especially fly. It was tuned perfectly to the Miami City Plex grid. It also had a full suite of offensive and defensive features stitched into it. The material, generally soft and pliable, could stiffen to protect against blunt force attacks. It absorbed and/or repelled scanning waves. It also emitted baffling signals to further obfuscate my location. It had deep pockets and hidden pockets. It also had a matching face mask, which filtered air and had gills in case I took a swim. Get yourself a good tailor. That way, when you want to be dressed to kill, you can fulfill the promise. It took some time to recalibrate my suit and myself for Miami's new security configuration, which I have made available for download. So if you need to go to Miami, make sure you get the update. But once all that was done and everyone rallied up, we hopped in 2 617s and put a bum runner SUV on autopilot and rolled out. As my mind continues to be changed by bad space, one of the good things that's happened is that I've developed some kind of eidetic memory and an unparalleled sense of direction. This doesn't mean I remember everything with perfect clarity, but roads I can recall, and weirdly, I can always navigate with no problems, even when those roads change. Sliding through the back alleys and over service roads and riding the machine routes that lace the city together behind the shimmering glass, buildings and cultivated front streets felt good. It also helped me to reacclimate to the city before we got busy on this rescue mission. It's no coincidence that modern city planning and management is modeled after biological sciences. A city of 15 million people between citizens and non-citizens with three folds and an active space deck behaves like a living organism. Tardatatech is the brain and is as such is connected to the central nervous system that spans throughout the entire city. I could make a myriad of analogies about what part of the city is like what organ, but what's most relevant is that, like organs, parts of the city are generally self-contained. Some of you are about to find out you've never been outside of your node in the city. If you grew up on grid, take a moment to look at your location data and see how far you actually made it out of your neck of the woods. If driving into the core of a city doesn't raise the hair on the back of your neck, you must have shaved it bald. The New York City grid stood in sharp contrast to the rest of the city of Miami, not only because of their distinct style and color palette, but because the light emitted from that piece of the grid was a different shade and shimmer. The Di-Fi changes the way light bends, so every city has a unique hue that can be used to identify it. New York is U.S. dollar green, not a coincidence. Miami is a nice sky blue with a hint of pink. Even after all this time, the city just can't shake that 1980s Art Deco kind of thing. There are only a few places where the back roads we like to travel intersect with the main roads or are close enough where switchover gates can be installed. If you find one, then mark it. Driving on grid is dangerous because 99% of cars are automated, Di-Fi linked, and don't always see our vehicles particularly well, one of the downsides of being machine invisible. Now, unless you're a Class 1 driver, you see the higher one, or trust the built-in piloting and navigating systems to control your car and get you where you need to be. Again, make sure you update it. Dipping onto the highway and heading into the central city plex, the first thing I noticed was the heart of the city was at the center of three ring roads, each of which could be sealed off into closed loops, so we drove into a trap. I didn't make my way directly to the location. Monaco and I cruised around for a while. Cam and Cakes were in another car and they took their own route, doing the same thing, as well as the SUV on autopilot. This is how we surveyed the area to get updated maps and make sense of the data we already had. Luckily, the changes to the city were mostly cosmetic, so our old scans of Miami were fairly reliable. The driving around also made us less conspicuous. In case someone was monitoring the streets by some means we didn't know about. There was some strange signals that we picked up on the Di-Fi that we couldn't resolve, so we knew we were going into a potentially dangerous situation, partially blind. One of the things we had working for us was that Unit 675 had chosen the softest possible target for an entry point. The door was for low-level employees and non-secure packages. It was also on the corporate side of the building and not the city side where the security was super tight. One of the sweet features that's standard on your signal searcher is anytime parking. It basically hijacks a car and forces it to move. On behalf of the static core, my personal apology to the millions of people who have walked out of work to where they thought they parked their car only to find it missing. Chameleon clothes have the ability to change color, shape, texture. It's a miracle of modern fibers and allows us to blend in. When we hopped out of our cars, it was right in the midst of a shift change, so hundreds of people were moving up and down the sidewalk into Tardatatech. And we looked just like them. Remember when I told you how important it is to read the grid? One of the easiest ways to get spotted in the second flex is to walk in the wrong direction at the wrong time. Even though this is a soft entry point, we still have to pass a retina scanner, our gate is profiled and checked, and there are probably used genetic screeners as well. So we had to pass through the barriers that quickly retract. Mission prep is essential. While on the way to Tardata, Cakes identified some people who were supposed to be punching in for work and sent them a false message to go home so we could take their place. With some simple tuning of our signal searchers, we were able to push an image of those persons to all the security cameras. Only someone looking directly at us with no lenses and their internal medical optics turned off would have been able to see our true faces. The source of the strange signal we had been picking up on grid near Unit 675 static beacon wasn't immediately obvious, but once we cleared the security and started to make our way into the building, it had some strange architecture. Usually a walkway like the one we went into would lead to a long concourse that would branch off into hallways, or if they were feeling fancy, there might be some staircases that led to the hallways. Either way, in short order, they would end up in large rooms full of cubicles. Instead, what we found was a hallway spiraling down and getting wider, and as it did, it ended up going down 3 stories. What was stranger was that people on the left side of the hall were being diverted into some side door, while everyone else went on up the hall. Unit 675 was to the left, and what was later determined was that the strange Di-Fi signal was this wrinkle they built into the grid to hide their location. Going through the side doors, we immediately saw a change in the field, and when people stepped inside, they were put on offensive mode. Fortunately, our HUDs threw up a warning that the people around us were in attack mode and highlighted people who were packing weapons or had special training. Standing in a room with 50 people, we played it cool as the door we came in closed. Before us was a large door with opaque glass. We turned our scanners on high and started looking closely at the room and noticed it was a weird amalgamation of pieces from all over the building. That's when I got a time dilation message warning. But this time, the source was static. And when I looked at my watch, the shadow was behind the second hand, so someone was slowing down time a lot. I remember feeling woozy when I walked in. That's a side effect of extreme time manipulation. Again, though, the experience of the passage of time didn't change. Playing with time in the first flex is fairly common. Doing it in the second flex is dangerous because it can cause a cascading destabilization of the Di-Fi and the whole city could come apart. I only had a moment to worry about that because the workers in the room started getting hype, shouting, slapping themselves in the face, bouncing up and down. Their fight instincts were being ramped up, and based on the data that was coming from our HUDs, some of them were real bruisers. While the digital field can be used to fully automate a person, such use is complicated and wreaks havoc on the body. Ambulatory control is a matter of finesse. They prep a subject for particular kinds of actions and then egg them on. From what I hear, it feels like free will. When the door slid open, the first thing I got was a signal confirmation for Unit 675's beacon. I saw them at the center of the room looking like they had been in a battle for God knows how long. They had been beat to pieces, but that didn't stop them from brawling. We didn't jump in right away. It was apparent Unit 675 was running some kind of gambit down there, and our intervention, without knowing the deal, could have blown things up. It was also apparent they were struggling. The people they were fighting weren't that proficient. Any team of 4 new recruits using proper tools and techniques should have been able to handle 50 people and get out of there. Unit 675 was anything but new recruits. They had actually started a mission to take down Tardata Tech, which they were more than qualified to do. But watching them in that basement, they just looked a mess at that moment. I've been known to stretch out a fighter's delay tactic or to draw out someone that's not, but that's not what they were doing. Their hand-to-hand combat skills were almost non-existent. They didn't use any collaborative attacks. They weren't deploying any psycho tactics. It was clear immediately something was wrong with them. Cakes took the gamble and decided to jump in the fray first. After turning on her Fi-Dye, the field disruptor is a handy tool that does what the name implies. It disrupts the digital field. It's handy for weakening security, overcoming locks, but in this case, it discombobulates anybody connected to the Di-Fi. So their attacks are uncoordinated and the signals that they're getting get scrambled. Hand-to-hand combat is another one of my favorite things, and surprisingly still useful even in this world with all manner of lethal technologies that can be deployed at distance. Another feature of Super Skin is augmented strength, but there are all manner of other physical hacks and augments you may choose to discuss with your doctor. Even with brawling, too much force can create problems. I could have gone one hitter and dealt out headshots and broke a lot of bones, but just like guns, less can be more. Working in combat situations like this, the harder is harder than it looks. Training to fight is one thing. Training to fight as a group is another, and more complicated than learning to use guns as a squad. Kicking and pushing some of the employees just hard enough to knock them off balance leaves them open for attacks from someone else. Occasionally, I would put someone in a hold and Cam or Cakes would deliver a few shots to finish them off. As a squad, we made short work of the 50 people, leaving them all stunned with a partial paralytic. It's a nice cocktail that fools the digital field into making them think they're still fighting, even though they're just rolling around on the ground. Taking stock of 675, at that moment, from the look in their eyes, I could tell they were full of cottage cheese. It's like Swiss cheese, but usually not permanent. Luckily, they responded to the standard static core code set, so they weren't completely gone, but at that time, they couldn't answer the most basic questions about where they were, why they were there, or what the goal of their mission was. They were also living out of a large vault, surviving on emergency kits. I eyed the armored shipping container and recognized this design as one from the War Bank Blade and Cannon, which is how we ended up there later. Unit 675 suffered a lot after Pharaoh died in the wall. They wanted to take down Tardata Tech but could never finish the mission. There is a supplemental report that details their struggle and, more importantly, how they were among a group of units singled out as causing the decline of the core's strength in the region and blamed for why Unit 2 Plus Alpha decided to cede it. Eventually, what I was able to piece together about how they ended up in that weird pocket in Tardata's back door is as follows. They built an underground base with the vault in a spot they knew would eventually become part of Miami's Central Cityplex, a common tactic that makes it easier to infiltrate. Some digits seal themselves into bases for weeks or months and come out after they've been built over. Eventually they come back for their vault. But in this case, they weren't able to make it out for some reason, and Unit 675 just got stuck near the exit and triggered a security response. This all must have happened during a construction phase because they managed to hack into the design matrix and hide their location by skimming bits and pieces of the grid for the building they ended up hiding in, turning it into the shell before it actually became part of the entry and exit location that it was. This is an advanced use of skills that blew my mind. Pockets like this one that they had put together are hard to build and thought impossible to maintain. For months, employees would march in, get sloppily beat down. Unit 675 would patch themselves up and it would patch themselves up, patch up all the people they beat down, adjust their memories, and send them back out. Four shifts a day, every day, for months. This was the downside of their pocket. It was coded as a workroom, which had staff allocated to it, so if the people stopped showing up or couldn't get in, it would have sent someone looking for answers. They dilated the time so they could suppress and manipulate the security signals going out over the digital field. Any or all of those things could have been done on a dead piece of grid with lower level on a small scale, or even on some far-flung patch of the second flex. But right in the heart of a city, I don't suggest you try this unless you do what 675 did and steal a grid map. There's a short list of technologies that the Static Corps has a bounty on. A grid map is the only means by which a real-time decrypted full read of the digital field is possible. Until then, I'd only seen one other, and that was in Jack City, which is considered a small map since it's a Class 3 city. The map itself is 20,000 square feet. A grid map is technology we don't fully understand, but in essence, it's a sophisticated projection system that puts out a multi-layered, hyper-realistic projection that can peel away any subject on the digital field down to the atoms. It's also interactive. Most anything that can be seen can be touched. The view is not all-piercing, at least not for those who know how to shield themselves or their property, but such protections are reserved for those living in the highest spires of the roof or down in the dirt, like us. Unit 675 only had a few cubes of the map out, but they used it to build the shell and keep the security in check. 675 gave my unit the map for safekeeping and use that would benefit the entire Corps. They kept the $1 trillion bounty. One of the more useful services banks on and off grid provide these days is a retrieval and delivery service for deposits. Make sure you pick a bank that excels in this area. Before I went in the freezer, Blade and Cannon was top rated. I was surprised to find out that the bank was near collapse on top of having closed their offices in the region. When we first called them for a pickup, we got no response. Luckily, some of the people on the Ontario worked for the bank, and some of their execs were sympathetic to the fact several long-standing members, myself included, were in need. Had we known Unit 675 was hiding with their vault, we could have gotten Blade and Cannon's help sooner. Dryce was the point for 675, and for all the cottage cheese in his brain at that time, he was a master at manipulating the grid. I've done a lot of triple E's during my service, but this was a particularly fun one. The exit was fairly straight up. Dryce already had a plan in place for moving the vault out of the building. The escape was the hard part. Remember those three ring roads that wrapped around the core of the cityplex? I've never seen finer wheel work than what my driver DG managed to pull off for me and everybody else who was trying to get out at that time. Whoever gets lucky enough to get picked up by her, make the most of it. The exodus from Miami was again easy. We jumped into the backdrop of the city and burned it back to Palm Bay. For those unfamiliar, there are always three parts to making a getaway. The exit is just getting out of the building or the immediate area. But if someone has a fix on your location, your profile, they may have people on patrol or could even use some other means to scan the grid, you haven't really escaped. I failed to escape a few times, went off grid, and when I came back on, had heat on me, which made it hard to operate. Exodus is when you've completely cleared any surveillance, at least the kind that will ping as soon as you come on grid. because of the security around Tardata was so heavy, and because we had a big rig load to move out, we had to compromise the security and spread it thin. Based on what we knew of Miami's protocols, we knew the first thing they would do is lock down the ring roads. That was the main thing we had to keep from happening. Divide and conquer was the name of the game. Monaco and Cam went with Unit 675 despite their protests. We managed to get them to agree to ride in the vault as a last line of defense should things go wrong. Cakes was going straight for the street to start causing chaos on the roads. I was tasked with causing a high-level disturbance in the building. All this activity would spread the security thin and put them in a state of emergency, in which case they wouldn't lock down the ring roads so they could bring in more security forces. Now, the plan as we originally laid it out, I was supposed to cause a ruckus in the building, then bust out and get picked up by Cakes. But I got sidetracked by my love of pirating, and when available services on my signal searchers showed that drivers for hire were active in the area, I took advantage of the opportunity to do a little more pillaging. From the hidden room 675 had been held up in, I walked out and made my way to a couple of cubicle blocks. My first move was to drop suggestive routines on a few people in each of these rooms. Those are short-run programs that get people to do simple tasks. In this case, it was to try and hack into Tardata systems. I knew they would never get anywhere, but it would trigger security and bring out supervisors. I pulled the same move on a few of the supers, and that brought out the managers. They tend to come from observation rooms, which are tied into the building's executive network. Just as the city has a backdrop of roads and machine lines, so do the buildings themselves. This is how executives and security move around without being seen. My main goal was to make it look like there was a coordinated hack being run by people who worked for Tardata, and that it was not only low-level employees, but people in management as well. That's when I pretended to be a manager who was in on the gig and got myself hauled into a dark security office, one of the easiest ways to get disappeared on the grid.